Welcome to Overtures. This episode was recorded in June, a few months into Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which made our discussion of Russian theater, particularly Chekhov and the Wilma's production of The Cherry Orchard, very timely. We really had a wonderful time during this hour getting into some really interesting niche topics. All links are in the show notes. Take your seats. We'll be starting shortly.
Hi there, everyone. Hope everyone's doing well. Hope everyone's having a good Wednesday. Happy June. We've already, I think, might have already done one episode in June so far, but that's okay. I'm still going to say it again. but yeah, hope everyone's doing well. Tonys are this weekend, so that's exciting. Currently still looking for a place to tune and watch it, but that's okay. I'll figure it out. There's a lot of shows that I'm rooting for, so crossing fingers. I also need to see more shows, to be quite frank, but that's okay. We'll get there eventually. I hope everyone's having an amazing day. And with that, we'll go ahead and kick off this episode. So welcome to episode 33 of Overtures. My guest today is a graduate assistant at the Belfer Audio Archive at Syracuse University, where he is pursuing a master's in library and information science. They will be graduating in December and pursuing a career in arts librarianship and archives. He has a master's in theater from Villanova and a BA in theater from Le Moyne College. They have also trained at the Moscow Art Theater and National Theater Institute, as well as with Pig Iron and Complicité. As a creative, Travis reads for the Bay Area Play Festival, as well as currently working on a few plays of his own. Travis is passionate about unburying lost artists as well as their work, and strives to research and promote art that has been lost by time. I was so lucky to have worked with this human for a year in graduate school, and I'm so happy to get the chance to catch up. Such a smart person with perhaps the most knowledge of Chekhov that I've known. This is Travis Milliman.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for that, Laura.
Hi. Absolutely.
I have to send you over. I just saw something earlier this week on the Broadway World, and it was like a list of Tony viewing parties in New York. So like they're out there. I'll send it your way. I'll find it.
Yeah, no, definitely. Please do. Of course. You definitely know way more about Chekhov than other people that I know. So it's fun to be able to talk about that a little bit. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm no complaints. It's beautiful here in Syracuse. We had a lot of rain yesterday, but it's this nice kind of in-between day with more rain coming tomorrow. So yeah, it's lovely. How are you?
I'm good. It's like hitting that like golden hour time at the moment. So like right across the way from me just looks gorgeous. It's like the sun is like right on the bricks. It's very West Side Story-esque, but it's nice. It's nice. A little warm, but it'll cool down during the night. So, So I always like to say for guests, like, oh, how do we know each other? We know each other from Villanova.
Yes, okay. Good old VU we went to together.
Good old VU.
We had two shows together, right?
I know that we worked on Midsummer together. I wasn't at Villanova yet.
Oh my gosh, my timeline is all messed up.
Isn't that crazy to think about?
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, and then we had a few classes together here and there. Yeah. Did we have script analysis? I was trying to remember.
Yes, we had script analysis together. Mm-hmm. I forget else what I took that fall. I know my spring was, you weren't in the spring classes that were all COVID-y. Oh, you were in musical theater. Yeah, we did musical theater together.
Every time I hear that song from the prom, I still think of you performing Barry's at your class. Barry's Going to the Prom.
I love that song.
I'm always going to think about it. I'll think about you when I hear it.
But I love that song, yes.
It's so good. It's so good. And then we had a few acting experiences together, so that was fun.
Yes, in James' acting class. Pulitzer Prize winner, James Imes' acting class. Yes. Oh, I just love your shirt. Oh, my goodness.
I'm wearing the Great Comet shirt.
I should have worn mine.
Oh, my gosh. But, yeah, no, it's crazy. Yeah, and I saw Fat Ham last week, and you're seeing it next week. So you'll have to tell me what you think, because I know we both love James, and both love
James
the show.
Yes, man. Like, he's the best.
No. Yeah. Truly a genius.
Truly a genius.
So shout out to those who may be watching and are in the New York area. Please go see Fat Ham at the Public.
Yeah.
incredible.
Or if you're in Philly, his show Fairview just opened at the Wilma. So
yes, go see that too. Have you seen it?
I'm seeing that 2 days before Fairview. So I'm going home and I like extended my trip by a day so I could see Fairview first.
Okay. Yes. No, please tell me about that too, because I won't be able to make it down to see it, but I wanted to see it so badly.
I saw it off Broadway and it's yeah, it was great. So I'm sure he's going to kill it.
Oh, I love that. I love that so much. Ah, that's crazy. But yeah, getting back to, I guess, sort of the beginning of things for you. How did you first get started in theater?
So there's, I guess, kind of three different answers to that. So if we're just talking theater, like, what was my first experience? My first real experience, I would say, was Annie. I did Annie Jr. I feel like a lot of people, that's the
classic
show. A lot of people. So the way my school district worked in middle school, we had two middle schools. So they rotated who did the show every other year. So when I was in middle school, when I was in seventh grade, we got to do the musical. So we did Annie. I was Lieutenant Ward, who's like kind of he's like the one who in the very beginning like brings Annie back to Miss Hannigan, like flirts with Miss Hannigan. It's a cute little cameo. Yeah, so I did that in seventh grade, and then I like continued to do musicals in high school and like did some summer camp and stuff. But it wasn't until junior year of high school, we had this amazing director. Her name was Jenny Eisenhower. She's actually the granddaughter of President Eisenhower and President
Nixon. Oh, wow.
She's a Philly-based theater performer. She was just in Sister Act at Media Theater.
Amazing.
She's a Barrymore winner. She's awesome. I like love Jenny so much. And she is a Conestoga, where I went to high school, alum. And so she came back and directed our shows for a little bit. And I just loved Jenny so much. I wanted to spend more time with her. So I initially only did the musicals. And I skipped the fall straight play. Mm-hmm. And then my junior year, we did Our Town. I auditioned for it. I had like a like talent person role. It was great. I was a priest. It's funny now. So that was cool. And then kind of like the big, like, that was me like realizing, oh, like I like theater more than just like singing and stuff.
Right.
Big, big moment. My senior year of high school, they do a trip every year to go see a show. I didn't go to my senior year, but I went and saw. And my first show was Next to Normal, which was like an amazing show. I feel like it's kind of like for people like our age, it's like very important and like we loved it. I feel like for like younger people, it's fallen off a little bit. But if you haven't listened to Next to Normal, it's amazing. Seeing it just kind of like changed my life and like the way it made me feel. Right. Like I want to do this. So then I took a gap year, actually, because it was, like, the very end of my senior year, and I was supposed to go to Xavier in Cincinnati for biology. And, yeah, I have, like, an environmental science-y kind of background for, like, most of my childhood. Most people who know me know I'm a bird watcher.
That's awesome. I didn't know that about you.
Wow, I'm surprised you escaped that. Yeah, that's, like, especially loves bringing up that I, like, ornithological dramaturgy, she calls it. Like, if there's a bird in a play, like, I can
see. You're like, I got it.
So, all this meaning from, like, one little bird. Took a gap year, did community theater for that year, and went to school for theater at Lemoyne. I knew I kind of wanted to be in upstate New York. Both my parents are from up here, and I have a lot of family up here, so I could, like, be, like, away from family, but also I have, like, a support net if anything should go wrong.
Right.
But I didn't have like the portfolio or book or anything to like audition for Syracuse or Ithaca. So I went to Lemoyne. And they have an amazing theater program. I love it. They, KCATF, the Kennedy Center American Collegiate Theater Festival, they did that for many years and that opened doors for me.
Yeah.
Matt Chiarini, the director there, is a like just an incredible director. And it was really life changing.
That's really, really awesome. Would you say then, like working on like KCATF or otherwise, were any of those like your like overture light bulb moment of like, oh, this like I'm going to pursue theater, or was it like earlier?
What the exact light bulb moment is? I Next to Normal is probably like the exact light bulb moment. Yeah. I remember messaging Jenny right after and being like, hey, like help me. How do I like?
Yeah, how do I like do this?
How do I do this? Like I've never. I walked out of that theater like bawling and like I didn't know what stage dooring was. And my friend's like, yeah, stage door. It's so, like they dragged me over to stage door and like.
Yeah, and your first stage door experience is like after you've had this whole like emotional
thing. Yeah. And Diana, Alice Ripley wasn't even in that show. She was like out on she was sick or something, and it was after Aaron Tveit had left. But like there was still like it was just so
such
it was
an incredible cast.
And Adam Chandler Bray and I talked for like a very long time. It was very cute. I had this horrible pink polo on that was like very hoity-toity rich kid. I was just like, oh my god, it was
oh my gosh. So then I'm curious, with such a like a strong like connection to like Next to Normal and like seeing this like amazing show, how did then theater lead you into pursuing work in librarianship and archival work?
So that's like that's a long story. So I did the I got my BA in theater that included going to Moscow, which I'm sure we'll get to later.
Yes, I would love to talk about that.
Yeah, I did a postgrad semester at National Theater Institute, where I did the advanced directing semester. And then right after that, actually, I had a very dear family member, my aunt on my mom's side, passed away. Mm-hmm. And her son, my cousin, is also a very artistic human. He actually sings with Chanticleer Singers, who are like a national touring vocal group, Grammy Award winning. And so they are, when she passed away, I was like, oh, like I need to like do something. Like I just felt like I was getting stuck. I was working in a preschool at a time doing like preschool theater. And so I just shot Villanova an email being like, hey, like you sent me information. And that year they had an incredibly small incoming class. Mm. And so they were on me like really fast being like, hey, like we have spots if you want to come and can like take the GRE fast enough. So I took the GRE with like, two weeks worth of prep, I think.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Got in, and very quickly once at Villanova, we like our first day there, we met Sarah Wingo, who's the theater English librarian and a brilliant human being. Yeah, any wildcat can attest to how amazing Sarah Wingo is. And so Sarah and I worked a lot on my D-file my first year at Villanova. I did this very obscure Russian play that like four people in America know about called Zoys.
Love some dramaturgy.
And she helped me a lot. And then when it was time to graduate, a lot of people at Villanova are there and they either go on to like teach or they go on to do a PhD. Mm-hmm. And I had wanted to do the PhD, but then I kind of realized like, I don't know if I want to commit that much time to a degree, and B, I don't know if I want to be someone that has to write that much for its entire life. Like, I can talk my way out of anything. I like performing. I'm not a great writer. Yeah. So I was working in a public library on the time, just like a side hustle gig, and I was like, I'm just going to do it. Like, COVID had hit. I was like, not, like, there was no work. Like, I could either just kind of like fiddle my thumbs and like do like busy work, or I could like go back to school. Syracuse was giving like a quarter free tuition at the time to like get people come like do the program because no one was even going to school because of COVID. So it's kind of like everything kind of fell into place. Very, very similar to Nova, honestly. This one I was a little more self directed, but like I was like, I'm just gonna go back to school and be the next Sarah Wingo. Like, I like working in a library and I like theater, and Sarah has shown me that there's a way for those two things to come together. And so now I'm here working on this. I have one more semester left and then I'm going to be hitting the job. Yeah.
So exciting. And that definitely makes sense, just because I've seen like your dramaturgy work and the kind of research that you've done. It makes sense then that you're like, okay, libraries, I feel very comfortable in those and like understanding how they work.
So our professor, Bess Rowan, who's also an amazing Villanova person, when I told her, she was like, oh, that makes so much sense. And then she pulled out this one time I came to class right after we picked our topics for our Vision Informed papers, which is like the big theory class you take at Nova. And I walked in with like a stack of like, most people use like journal articles or like videos or whatever for their sources. And I walked in with like 18 books from the library that I used like my sources for that paper. So like she was like, it makes so much sense.
She's like, that clicks.
Yeah. And even since then, there's been a lot of things that have like kind of unearthed themselves that like, oh, like I've actually been kind of doing this my entire life. I just didn't realize it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh my God.
I love research. I love like digging through an archive. I actually did a lot of archival work for my thesis at Nova. at the Toft Archive at Lincoln Center
Theater. Well, especially since like your dramaturgy work was like, was that, that was through doing Midsummer Night's Dream, right? So it was a lot of Shakespeare research too.
There was a day, so the production of Midsummer Night's Dream that was my thesis that you were in, it was a very strange production, very dark production, very not typical production. And I think everyone's struggling to wrap their head around it. And even like PR wise, I feel like people didn't quite know how to handle it. So I decided to go to the Theater on Film and Tape Archive at Lincoln Center. And I spent a whole day watching productions of Midsummer Night's Dream. I just kind of like locked myself in the art. Like you go in advance, you like say, I watch this. And I watched like four or five productions of Midsummer Night's Dream that day. So, which was honestly great. And then my program note for that whole thing ended up being like different ways you can put a spin on this and how like we always consider it a comedy. But when you look into it, like the text is really malleable and like you can do a lot with it. And you can take it, you can take it dark, you can take it funny, you can take it absurd. Like there's so many ways you can roll with that play.
It's definitely like that kind of like archival sense of like, this is the amount of different ways you can do it. There's so many opportunities. It's crazy. And you've done so many things here and there theatrically. You've dramaturged, like we were talking about, you've directed, you've written work to be performed as well as academic, you've acted, well, at least in class. And am I missing any other things? And also outside, because of course, like high school and things like that.
Yeah, well, even in college, kind of the door that opened Russia to me. So do you know The Master and Margarita?
I don't.
It's a book by Mikhail Bulgakov. Highly recommend. Great summer read if anyone's looking for a good summer read. Mick Jagger from the Rolling Stones actually read it, and Sympathy for the Devil is about that book.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it's a great book. But in it, so the devil goes to Moscow, and he's trying to make people believe in both himself and God, because people are stopping believing in God. And as a result, like, there can be no devil without a God, so, like, you need that balance. And the devil brings with him like a retinue. And in the book, it is a, there's like this like vampirous, a choir master, this pirate named Azazello, and then a giant demon who takes the form of a cat named Behemoth. And I played Behemoth. And
I love that.
It's like my favorite thing I've ever done. I'm going to get Behemoth tattooed on me when I have the money for a tattoo that big. Like it was an incredible, incredible experience. Honestly, if it was a well done enough show or a commonly enough done show, I would travel the world and play Behemoth for the rest of my life.
I love that.
I like the way people do like that with Rent. Like, I want to do that with that show.
With that show.
But like, no one does it. So that was like how I like got to Moscow. But then also, I mean, when I was at Lemoyne, I did a ton of directing. When I did KCACTF, the second year I went, I assistant directed and sound designed Sarah Rule's Dead Man's Cell Phone.
That's an interesting one to sound design.
I love that play. Oh my gosh.
It's so weird. I love it.
Very, very strange.
For Sarah Rule, I really.
There's like the plot is very thin and it's almost more like a vibe than anything else. And so we went, we brought the show, we were invited to production, and like we did it and everything. But I was doing the SDC contest at the time, which is the directing competition. And I got second, that was my junior year. And I was going to go back and try and do it again senior year, but that fall is when I was in Moscow. I just feel like I didn't have time to prep it properly. And also the choices were weird. Like when I went, I picked this weird like adaptation of a Shakespearean sonnet. But that year there was also like there was a Paula Vogel and there was a Chekhov and there was like all these like great things. And then the year after that was like stuff that I would know now probably, but like I couldn't even pull one out of my head right now. Like, they were just weird titles I didn't know.
Yeah,
I was like, it's really hard to like put that much effort and energy behind something you're not passionate about. So didn't go back and go for the win, but I'm very proud of that year that I got second.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was really, really cool for me.
And I can imagine with like all these different roles that you've had in theater, that again still helps you when it comes to if you're doing like librarian or archival work that that pertains to theater, because you're like, this isn't just about the actors, this is about the designers, this is about all these people who put that work in.
Yeah, so I think like 15, 20 years ago when you did a BA or a BFA, you went in and you did one thing and you were trained in that one thing and put in that one box.
Right.
Lemoyne's whole thing is like, no. That's not how it works. It's changed a little bit. But when I was there, there was a strong focus on prepping you for regional theater, which meant you had to be able to act and then go backstage and help, like, set up a sawhorse. Like, you had to, like, do everything. So I got trained on how to do pretty much everything.
You worked in the prop shop, too, at Villanova.
Yeah, I worked in the prop shop at Nova. And that's why, Nova, when Valerie reached out to me about, like, wanting to go there, and I explained how, like, I don't like being put in a box. Like, I don't think that's how theater works anymore. Yeah. She was like, well, that's our whole thing, too. So
it really
worked out really, really well. Yeah. And yeah, definitely, I think it really helps apply. So we have a collection at the archives at SU. So I work in a sound archive, but they also have many, many, many different collections within special collections. And one of the ones that's kind of moved to fall under our archive, which is becoming almost more like the pop culture archive, if you will, is the Grove Press Collection. And in that Grove Press Collection, we have a ton of Beckett primary documents.
Oh, wow.
So I was just inventorying that like 2-3 weeks ago. And there's like press releases for Beckett. There's contracts for Beckett. A first edition. Oh my gosh, I'm blanking on it. The Woman in the Sand, Happy Days. First edition Happy Days. And I like lost my mind about that because that's my favorite Beckett. I love Happy Days so much. I got to see that with Diane Weiss a couple years ago. It was amazing. Oh, wow. I'm going through all these things. And like for a lot of people, it's just like, I don't think they understand the significance of certain types of documents in the collection. Like for me, the contracts are really interesting because the Beckett estate is so notoriously like difficult to work with. Like they want it away. You can't do any kind of inventive or creative casting. Like they want it without like really working them. Like they want how it was done when Beckett wrote it, basically. And Beckett is so weird and kind of thought provoking. It works for a lot of productions, but it was really cool. I didn't go like the way it works in my job. I don't have time to like really sit and go through them per se. I'm more their condition and that we have them. But I do, before I graduate, want to go back and like really spend time with those contracts. I'm curious what's in them.
Yeah. Just to learn more and be like, what's happening here?
Yes,
yeah. So I have an Instagram question for you. Here we go. We're talking about, you've also like written some here and there.
Yeah.
Chris wanted to know which play that you're writing is your most treasured one.
Oh, I love that. When I was in my second semester at Nova, Michael Hollinger was on sabbatical. Mm-hmm. So James Imes, Pulitzer Prize winning, we'll say it every time now.
Yes, every single time.
was teaching playwriting. Very first assignment he had us do was to, we wrote like 10 page scenes almost every single class. Mm-hmm. And so our first one we had to do was pick a play and adapt it. So obviously I picked Cherry Orchard by Anton Chekhov, which is like my favorite play. I adore it. And I wrote this play called E Anonymous, which is kind of a version of the Cherry Orchard, but it is an escort service in San Francisco. So talking about like the queer community and gentrification and kind of like the Disneyfication of the queer community. Like I do think there's a place for like familial and like kid-friendly things in the queer community. Like what's going on in Texas right now with trying to ban drag queens. Like that pisses me off so much.
Oh yeah, I could.
But I also do think like there is something about the queer community that like there should be a space where it's like more like adult and like the kind of the traditional values of queerness can be still happen without having to worry about like a kid walking in.
Right.
So you need both. And so that's what that play's kind of about. And I love it. 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 I've worked on it a lot. I'm kind of just like too scared to send it out. I like it so much.
No, I get that.
it's honestly, in my opinion, it's ready to go to like Playpen or the Bay Area or I don't know. The O'Neill is so clicky. I love them, but they're really clicky, so it's hard to get in there.
Try Playpen.
Yeah, I might do Playpen. We'll see. And they're back. Yeah, I want to see how the first season
back goes.
Because it's first COVID season, and then also first like all new leadership season. So
True.
I definitely want to see how that goes.
True. Sounds like an amazing play. I love it.
Yeah. And it's hard to produce, I've been told by people, because for those who know me, I'm a giant music nerd. And so I have like a lot of like licensed songs that would have to get dealt with, but I think it's a really cool play.
It can be worked with. Yeah. And you have such an, like, we were just talking about the amazing, like, your bio before, and there's so many experiences that you list in your bio that I want to hear more about. We may not be able to touch all of them, but first I want to start with Moscow Art Theater. It sounds like this came about through your undergrad program, but what all did it contain? What was that experience?
So like I said, I played Behemoth and the Master and Margarita and kind of fell in love with Russian drama. Matt Chiarini, who I was talking about, the director at Lemoyne, he did the ART program at Harvard. And the way it used to work is that NTI sent a cohort to the Moscow Art Theater in the fall, and Harvard sent a cohort in the spring. So Matt basically did the same program I did, saw kind of my affiliate, my love of like Russian theater. I had to study abroad actually, because I was a double major in undergrad. So I did theater, but I was also a peace and global studies major with a concentration in Eastern European democracy and human rights. It's a mouthful.
That's crazy.
I had to study abroad. I was all set to go to Prague spring my junior year, and Master Margarita happens. And I was like, I'm not missing this. So then I went to Russia in the fall. It's a pretty kind of like self-selecting program. And it's on pause right now, obviously, because of what's going on there.
Right.
But hope to God it comes back, because it's really sensational. We went to NTI first, and you do like a week-long orientation at NTI where you do...
And that's the National Theater Institute,
National Theater Institute in Waterford, Connecticut. It's lovely. I love NTI, a birthplace of such things as In the Heights, Avenue Q. Really, really amazing people come out of there. At the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center. We go there for a week, and we did an orientation that consisted of, like, they taught us some self-defense. This is the thing with Moscow. Moscow gets the scary, scary representation from the West. And it's a city. It's like any other city. So, like, you have to have your wits around you. But, like, it's really not that different than going to, like, New York or D.C. Like, it's really, really not. Yeah. And even, like, Russia in general, when people, like, villainize it, I'm like, guys, like, it's the same thing, like, here. Like, if you...
Like, it's like, leaders who don't have their shit together.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just on over there, it's the right now. Like that's who's in power. And the issue is that they're so in power that they aren't going anywhere anytime soon. So we did a week of stuff at NTI, and then we take the 12-hour flight from JFK to Moscow. And we do a little bit more orientation there. They try to get us to work decent with Cyrillic and like basic Russian. Because that's definitely, when I got off the plane and couldn't read anything, I was like,
That's really difficult, too. It's like, this isn't very, even, like...
Very culture shock. Yeah. I slept for, like, 24 hours, because I was just kind of, like, in shock.
Yeah.
The schedule is kind of, it's very the same. The way it works is in the morning, your days rotate, and you either have, you have Russian language almost every day. And then you have like a 4-hour acting class in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. In the mornings, you would have rotating ballet with a very strict ballet master. Ooh. He and I did not always click, but I was not there to learn ballet. Russian movement, which is also known as Drosnin, which is amazing, 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 amazing. Stage combat. With this guy Slava, who would do things like slap a chair against his forehead and be like, "I'm not hurt, I'm okay." Is a crazy man, but I also love him. He's like a cage fighter on the
incredible.
Side.
Incredible.
He's terrific. And then singing with a retired opera singer design. Design was like kind of sprinkled out throughout this semester, and we'd meet with like the head designers of like the Moscow Art Theater. The youth theater, which is like a very big theater there. It's not kids, it's just called youth theater. Sundays we had off. That was our day to like explore the city.
Yeah.
Saturdays we had just acting, and then we had a film class in the morning. So we'd watch Russian cinema and talk about it. That was really cool. And then Tolya Smelyansky, Anatoly Smelyansky, who is a very, very important person in theater. You should Google him if you don't know who he is. He was the artistic director at the Moscow Art Theater for a very long time. And is now, I honestly, I'm not sure if he's still with us, but if he is, he's living on Cape Cod with his daughter. So Tolya would like kind of pop in whenever it worked in his schedule and give us like theater history courses.
That's really special too.
Oh my gosh. An incredible human being. Is it on my bookshelf right now? He has a book out right now, or a book out called, he's a book, it'll come up. It's like, it's about Stanislavski, and it's really wonderful. And kind of talks about like the relationship of theater and like Russian history and dealing with like the Cold War. And it's like, it's a really terrific book. I highly recommend.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That sounds like that was such a cool semester to be able to do that. And
it was amazing. Yeah. I have a hard time. People get like annoyed with me sometimes with how much I bring it up, but like, it's just like ingrained in my DNA now. And like, I mean, I'm queer, if that wasn't obvious, like I like would love to go back. It's not safe for me there right now,
yeah.
But like I would like absolutely love to go back. And my favorite thing about it. So in Russia, they supplement the arts way better than we do here in the States.
Oh yeah.
Everything is government supported and like, it's fantastic. We're there during the first round of sanctions. We were there when they were invading Crimea. Mm-hmm. The theater was dirt cheap. So I was seeing like Broadway level theater and or La Jolla Playhouse level theater for like $5 a night, $7 a night.
That's insane. The month
of November, except for Thanksgiving, because we weren't allowed to, I went to theater every single night and I spent a total of $75 US.
That's wild. Yeah. That's so impressive.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Like, so sometimes it was opera too, because there's so much opera there, but like, it was amazing. Yeah, it was just like, if anyone had the chance to catch the Wilmots production of Cherry Orchard that just closed, Dmitry Krimov, who I adore, that's where I got to meet him, and I saw all of his work over there. He's, in my opinion, like the greatest living theater artist. He's just amazing. The way they work over there, it's very director driven, and like, yes, there is collaboration with the actors. But there's a certain degree of like directors controlling the actors like chess pieces and just how the actors are trained. And like an actor can make a suggestion, but you're going to have a back and forth based and rooted in usually Stanislavski, sometimes Meyerhold, to like make sure that it makes sense.
Yeah.
And a lot of them also work in something called an etude, which is basically an event. It's like a mini little like scenelet.
Yeah.
Although sometimes they're really long. And so it'd be like the etude of like pouring a glass of tea, a cup of tea, or like the etude of catching the bus.
Yes.
We had to come in and like with an etude in groups every single day. Because some of the directors, and especially we had two masters, Ilya and Sergei. Ilya worked this a little more than Sergei did. Like a lot of them like working in these etudes. So our show, we were there, was Cherry Orchard. That's why I like it so much. So we would come in and be like, he would say, okay, your group do the etude of Fears Getting Left Behind at the end. Your group do the etude of Dunyasha packing her suitcase. Mm-hmm. And like, we'd have to like do these etudes and then we'd come back and they would get like sewn together into something.
A full play. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And I'm curious, you have such a strong like knowledge of Anton Chekhov's work and perhaps Russian theater as a whole, since you were studying abroad there, but did you have that passion for Chekhov before going there? Or was it like really strengthened by being there?
Like I said, my mentor at Lemoyne, Matt Chiarini, did this program when he was in grad school. Mm-hmm. And so we did a lot of Chekhov at Lemoyne, never like a fully mounted production, but it was always like geared into the coursework. I had just seen like a Three Sisters my freshman year, and like we did a lot with Siegel. And that was Stupid Effing Bird by Aaron Posner came out around that time. And that was like a play du jour that like everyone was looking at. So like, we looked at that in class. I think Tom Stoppard's Cherry Orchard came out around that time. Like, so there was a bunch of like things kind of in the ether.
Yeah.
I was absorbing. And then I did all the stuff with Master Margarita by Bulgakov, who's also a playwright. So I had some going in, and then I went in and it just like, it's like getting dunked in a dunk tank where like you're just, and so Chekhov and Stanislavski, like the Moscow Art Theater is there, is like, that's why it's what it is today, because of them. So you just get like quite the education on those two men.
Yeah. I'm sure it's just filled with them. And because we've talked about it like a little bit here and there, I'm curious. So obviously the Wilma did a production of The Cherry Orchard, and I heard such amazing things about it. Did you see it?
Yeah. Oh, I saw it twice. Yeah. I saw it, second weekend, Friday night. And then I bought a ticket for Saturday night too.
I heard such wild things about the production. So I'm curious, like what made that production so special in particular?
So it's not Cherry Orchard. This is what Dima, what Krimov does, is he like takes an idea. He takes The Cherry Orchard. He takes Three Sisters. I saw his Don Quixote when I was in Moscow. Like he takes an idea and like blows it up and like tapes it back together with like scotch tape and chewing gum, and then like puts an idea on it. Like Russian theater is so much about the idea. Mm-hmm. So they, or at least the Russian theater I was exposed to, because there definitely is like classical museum theater there. This Cherry Orchard, so Dima got on the last plane out of Moscow before planes stopped coming west, basically. Mm-hmm. Literally the very last plane. And so he was very affected by what was going on in Ukraine. I mean, he worked in Ukraine. He has friends in Ukraine. He was getting updates from them because it was at a time also when like Moscow communications were spiffy. Like I have friends in Moscow who I would try and communicate with, and I would like have to wait until they were like allowed to communicate again.
And so
the whole production was very, very focused on like loss. Dima has not gone back to Moscow. He is I believe currently somewhere in Eastern Europe, but not Moscow. He like really like, put a lot of like what was going on into Ukraine, like the loss of kind of his country, like the loss of the orchard in the production. Mm-hmm. Something cool that they did with this production that they did not realize, and then when I got to watch a couple of the dress rehearsals, because his translator, Tatiana Hykin, was my translator when I was in Moscow. So like she's just like her group mom, basically. I love Tatiana dearly. So she had me come in for a couple of rehearsals. They had this giant train board. And maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, Philly had one of those for a very long time at 30th Street Station, and then took it down and replaced it with a digital board. Mm. It was a whole thing. It was like big news coverage for quite some time. And so I was like, Philly will, using that as a metaphor, like Philly will understand. Like,
yeah,
lucked into the right metaphor here, guys. So to me, like, there's this great moment in the play where they play volleyball. That's not in Cherry Orchard, but Demon.
Yeah.
They're playing volleyball, and then actors, the actor plays Fears, and the actors who plays Gaev, they step out and give these speeches kind of about loss and like what it means to be an artist in the year 2022. And there's this Swiss book that they quote, and they talk about slaying the dragon, which like I am not doing it justice explaining it, but it's just a gorgeous, heart-wrenching monologue. They talk about like kind of quotes from Dima, from like his friends in Ukraine. It opened literally like 6 weeks after Ukraine got invaded, I want to say. And so it was really like what he does so well is make things feel timeless and relevant at the same time, which is like, I don't know anyone else who's done it. Diane Paulus gets there sometimes, I guess, but like there's like, it's very, very hard to do. It's just amazing. Amazing.
And I think that ties into like where you were going at the end there. I think that ties into another Instagram question that we had, which was also from Chris, which where he was asking, where did your passion for reviving writers' lost unloved works to the world come from? Where did that passion come from?
I love this question. So two parts to this. It's not so much writers for this right now. I mean, I'd love to do writers as well. Although maybe I guess it is kind of writers too. But my right now is music, and music has always kind of been my first love. I love theater dearly, but music has always kind of been number one. And so I grew up with very musical parents. My mom has a gorgeous voice. And my dad is one of those people who can pick up any instrument and play it within an hour. It's amazing and annoying at the same time. At a pretty, like, I don't know, I was probably like 19 or 20, told me about Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who is a very important Black musician, who basically invented rock and roll, but was buried by time until like 2016 or 17, I want to say.
Yeah, a few ripoffs.
And people knew about her, but like they didn't really like give her credit. And she was finally inducted into the Rock Hall in, I want to say, 17. And she's buried in Philly in what was for a long time an unmarked grave, but I think that has changed since. But so when I was like, well, if she's like this important person, like, why don't more people know about her? And then that kind of like sent me down a rabbit hole of like other, especially like Black Americana, Black roots, Black gospel artists that like basically did what people like Elvis and the Beatles and the Stones did. Led Zeppelin famously ripped off like a lot of Black roots music. And so I'm really into like promoting that and like giving people their due. I think that's really important. And then I guess actually I probably one of the reasons I hadn't thought of this till this question. So thank you, Chris. Probably one of the reasons Bulgakov, who wrote Master and Margarita, really like stuck with me is that Master and Margarita was lost for a very long time. So he wrote it. And then Soviet Russia was like, no, we can't have this out there. And it was like gotten rid of.
Right.
And I believe it's kind of a Hamilton situation. His widow kept the manuscript.
Wow.
And so he like eventually in like the mid-century that got published, but it was like after he had died, many years after he had died. And so like I think there's examples throughout time of artists being lost, and I think there's only like a small percentage getting discovered. And I really like, so the collection I'm working with right now at the archive we're about to finish is this Latin American 45 collection. So 45 is a 7-inch vinyl. And a lot of it's really rare recordings that either haven't been heard in like 60 years or have like never been heard in America, at least.
Wow.
So we're working on getting that up and going for research very, very soon. But so I came from my dad, honestly. Like, my dad is like a big influence on me in a lot of ways. I mean, so a lot of kids grew up with like watching like Back to the Future or like watching like kind of like Indiana Jones, and like we grew up watching like The Point before it kind of had a renaissance in the aughts, which is like this trippy psychedelic film. Or like back in the day, the Disney Channel used to show like the cheesy 60s Godzilla movies late at night. To like record those for us. Like, my childhood canon is like very different from most people, and I think that shaped how I like look at art, how like I can appreciate kind of the mainstream, but I like going deeper and seeing what's there.
And you were talking a bit about the archival work that you're doing currently, and you sent in a few pictures. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen, but if you want to preface it a little bit.
Absolutely. So I sent kind of two projects I'm working on right now, or two collections I'm dealing with, I should say, right now, at the Belfer Audio Archive at Syracuse. So one of them is this Latin American 45 collection. And then one of them is these 16-inch, like, super vinyl, if you will. And so this one that we're looking at right now is one of these 16-inch vinyls, which you'll see in a minute. I put my AirPod case on it so you could kind of get an idea of size.
Yeah.
Most records that people are used to dealing with are 12 inches. So this is 4 inches, like, larger than most of them.
That's huge.
And so this collection is another one that, like, it's been sitting in the archive for so long, and it's just been an issue of having manpower to deal with it. I took the case off there. But a lot of these are like kind of big band recordings that are going to be digitized for researchers. But also, if you have means to get to the archive, they are open to the public. You just have to request access to them. So this is our setup. Way long before COVID was a thing and everyone had a ring light, Belfer Archive has been using kind of this ring light setup to help photograph images. These 16 inches, I'm very lucky, are already clean. so they can just be photographed without having too much processing. So we have this ring light and this camera. It's a very simple, like, I can't share specs exactly, but it's a very simple, like, Nikon camera that, like, someone would have in high school for a photography class.
Yeah.
So next picture, it goes on that table. So this is the back of the record. There's no song on this.
It's so detailed.
It's so pretty. Oh my, and the ring light kind of ruins it, but, like, I wanted to make sure I could, like, show it to you properly. They have this beautiful design in the back, and we're actually not, if a researcher wanted to see this, they totally could. But we're not, like, putting the pictures of the back out there just of time. Like, if there's so many of them, I was to take a picture of all the backs. And it's ultimately just an aesthetic thing. It's not.
You wouldn't expect, like, the back of this record to just be, like, etched in this, like, glorious design with the logo.
Yeah. And they all have the same etching on the back, too. So if we do one, then that's good enough. Yeah. But so underneath that table, we have this machine that foam and board is very important in archival work. And so we have this machine that cuts custom foam and board to make it safe to put on that table there. We can go to the next one.
Yeah.
So this is what I'm getting. I'm capturing this picture, and I forgot to zoom in on this one, so you'll see it with the 45s. But on a label like that, there's so much information for a researcher.
Yeah.
It'll be matrix numbers, recording numbers, the studio it was recorded at. There's a lot of info there that is really important to people researching, specifically when it comes to cultural things.
Yeah, because I see, like, Works Progress Administration on here, and, like, that's a very specific time period. Like,
yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so this is kind of a boring disc, I think, but there's some discs that are, like, I want to say one is, like, the colored vocal ensemble or something like that. And so it's from, like, the 30s and the 40s. So it's, like, really cool early BIPOC work that, like, I would love to get out there.
Yeah.
We can skip this one. So that goes especially onto these Latin 45s. So we have literally, like, tens of thousands of these, probably. And they've been working on this collection for 5 years. They brought me in because they bought this sonic bath that if they had someone to operate, would make this process go a lot faster. So they brought me in to operate it, realized that I knew what I was talking about, and let me do other stuff. This is what I get. I get a picture of this when 5 years ago, maybe probably even longer ago than that, they brought in an outside company to take pictures of all of these vinyl discs. I get a picture like that. And then if you want to go to the next slide, I then use just pretty basic photoshopping techniques to, like, make a spot to zoom in on. And then I get in the next slide a close-up of the label with all the info on it. Mm-hmm. But what you can't really see here, which you'll see in the next one, in the bottom left, there is that, like, wording, if you will. It's like numbers. So that's really important to researchers. So we've actually, the Belfer Audio Archive has developed a filter that Library of Congress has now taken from us. It helps process these images faster so researchers can get the information that they want or need.
Yeah. And so, then this last one.
Yeah. So you can see it's the number on the bottom there, on the bottom left, way down. It's like, it looks like scribbling almost.
There.
So, and these Verns, I was kind of sad I had to give you a Vern because that's what I was working on today. But the Verns were, you can see here, they're filthy. So when I was cleaning them, it took, like, forever. Most of them are covered because they're from the 50s and 60s in, like, tobacco and nicotine and, like, grossness. On the large discs, when you get this image, which I forgot to give you, I apologize.
That's okay.
Very clean, like, you can see that number. These discs are so dirty, you can see them, but you, like, really have to zoom in. And so what will probably end up happening is our catalogers will put something on there along the lines of, like, re-imaging available upon request or something like that. Because the collection is so big. If we were to go through and re-image them, now they're clean.
For all of them, it would take forever.
It would take a long time. It would be very expensive, which is ultimately the issue of archiving, is that, like, it's very expensive and time you're racing against time, really. I mean, we have audio tapes that are predicted to disintegrate within 15 years. And there's some important ones. I mean, I just collection that we had sent out. I'm going to butcher his name, I think. I think his name is Brian Davies, I want to say. He's a biographer. His two most famous works are Einstein: A Life. And then he wrote a biography on Tallulah Bankhead, which is who Cruella de Vil is based off of, fun fact. But he's a golden age of Hollywood actress. And on those tapes for the Tallulah Bankhead one are all these amazing golden age of Hollywood people. Joan Crawford and Dorothy Parker and like interviews with them. And then the last tape is an interview with Tennessee Williams that I'm like dying to get my hands on. Yeah. But when it's ready, I will be.
Yeah. Those are imperative to get converted so that you don't lose them forever just because they could disintegrate.
Exactly. And those luckily have been converted. By now they're probably, you can access them. It's just a matter of like getting it out there. And Belfer is understaffed right now, unfortunately, due to COVID. So once they just restarted hiring people in like the last 6 months. So hopefully that'll get fixed soon and Belfer will be fully staffed, but we'll see. We'll see what happens with that.
Well, that's really cool, amazing work that you're doing with the archive. It's so fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned before, like when we were first thinking about getting you here on the show, that you work lots of different odd jobs while pursuing theater.
Oh, yes.
And I think this is always such a fun conversation and that needs to be discussed more it's a survival job, you know? What are some of the ones you've had?
Yeah, and so and one of them, working in a library, led to me getting this degree and this job that I'm
it's more than just like a thing I have to do.
starting at the beginning, I spent a very long time. It's hard to get the exact year count because I was kind of on and off for a little bit. Working at my local YMCA. So I grew up going there. It was kind of like my saving grace when I was a teenager and like struggling with stuff. And when I was 15, they hired me to do summer camp, but I stayed on. And while I was in high school, they have a nature center with like turtles and an iguana and snakes and bunnies and like all kinds of things. Now they have a micro farm attached to the nature center. They have hawks now too. They have a zoo basically. So I got hired to as part of the environmental youth service group that was there called YMCA Earth Service Corps, which is a chartered thing, but based out of Seattle, but this YMCA had a location or had a organization. On weekends would go and feed the animals. And like, that was like my first thing. But I stayed at that YMCA for a very, very long time and doing all kinds of different things. So, I did camp for a very, very long time. I did preschool for a very, very long time.
Yeah. I'm interested to hear about that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So I have like very, in retrospect, very mixed feelings. Like I was clearly taken advantage of to a certain extent. But like amazing people who I would like to this day, I talk to all the time and like love them dearly. And like, I've been to several weddings recently. Aww. Like I love them. One of them is like a second mother to me. It was weird stuff was going on. I was also taught preschool theater courses, also like elementary school age theater courses, which both of those things are really just kind of like controlled play.
Yeah, because I'm like, there's not a whole lot in terms of like, a syllabus for the class.
No. Yeah. Preschool ones, it was a lot of like physicality and like physical theater. One of my favorite companies in the States is Synetic in Arlington, Virginia, who do a lot of like silent kind of dance theater. And so for like my first and second graders, we did like that for one of our performances, which was went over really well. It was super cool. But so lots of things at the Y. I worked at the library, like I said. At the same time I was working at the library, I worked at a florist shop and was delivering flowers and doing event setup and takedown. Valley Forge Flowers in Wayne, it's a really nice flower shop. It is very high profile. The owner is like one of the top people on QVC. We did things like, I of course was not there this day, but like my friend Jim did like Joel Embiid's Christmas decorations 1 year.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you know, like you do. And like the Philadelphia Flower Show, they're always like a centerpiece of. It's like it's kind of a big deal. So I did that. There was a year I spent as a secretary for an insurance company. that was great. Honestly, it just wasn't for me. Like, it was, yeah, it was a lovely environment, great people. I just like sitting at a desk doing Excel sheets all day.
You're like, not, I know.
Yeah, not for me. I need to use my hands. And I'm missing one. What am I missing here? I did for a couple years here and there. I did. I call this an odd job, even though it's theater. I stage managed kind of a children's musicals for a couple summers in college. Mm-hmm. It's similar to summer stock, but not. It's kind of like the school takes advantage of students being there. We stay an extra like month and a half, 2 months, and we do a 4 month run of a children's musical. So I did Knuffle Bunny and Elephant and Piggy Wearing a Play. We had children coming in every single morning at 10 a.m. for a show. And then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we would do shows. And they super, super popular in the area. Yeah, so lots of things.
So many fun ones. But also, I'm sure some that you've, like you were just saying, like lasting impressions, even though they're odd jobs, quote unquote.
The florist was great. The library was obviously amazing. Children's theater was great. Like, the only one that I look back at, and it's probably because I was there, like I worked at that YMCA in some capacity from ages 15 to 27. So it was like a very long time. Like I'm about to turn 30. So like it's kind of recent still. So like it's definitely like, I don't know. And it's, I'm still processing it, honestly. Like I said, I love those people.
Yeah. Just
kind of two times in kind of big ways. I feel like it could have ended better.
Yeah. Understandable. Yeah. But it's those experiences that make up who we are today, for better or worse. And absolutely. So, yeah, it's fun to always like hear like, oh, what other things have you done? Because they're always going to be something so different from person to person. Mm-hmm. And that's so fun about theater people, but yeah, it's crazy. Absolutely. We've already made it to the end. We're almost at an hour.
It's been an hour.
Yeah. Isn't that insane? What?
I love that.
So where can people like find you on the internet and that kind of thing?
So on Instagram and Twitter at Setlist Vulture. SETLIST Vulture. I don't do a lot on Twitter. It's usually me screaming into the ether about Drag Race. I'm a big Drag Race person. Instagram, come find pictures of me at shows and at concerts and such. Yeah, and those are the best places to hit me up.
Amazing. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Laura_Marjoram. Much like Travis, I'm not nearly as much on Twitter, but I am on Instagram much more. Yeah. I also have my website, www.lauramarjoram.com. If you made it to watching this episode, congrats, you found the YouTube channel. You're here. Yay. Give us a follow, like, comment, join us live, say hi, all that good stuff. You can also find the show on Instagram at Overtures Show. There's two S's. And now you can actually start listening to the show on Apple Music and Spotify. I'm slowly working through the back catalog, so that's been fun. So I'm releasing like two a week currently until I can get closer to today. And then it'll probably be back to once a week. But yeah, go check out those older episodes. And then any recent ones you can, again, find on the YouTube channel. Travis, do you have any final thoughts for viewers live and in the future?
Oh my gosh, final thoughts. My favorite quote that I say when anyone asks me for like an end line like this, David Bowie has this great line, "I don't know where I'm going next, but I promise it won't be boring." And I just think that's a great mantra to live by theater. Like, just go with the flow. Just don't be boring. Boring sucks. Don't do it.
And with that incredible wisdom, which I love, by the way, yeah, that's the end of our episode. But thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. And I hope you all have a good day.
Bye. Bye.